Tantor Audio, a division of Recorded Books, presents Soldiers Out of Time by Steve White, narrated by Andrew Iden. Chapter 1. In the claustrophobic confines of the subterranean tunnel, the sound was deafening as the near-fusion temperature discharge from the Mark 11 plasma gun roared down its laser guide beam. And the star-like glare would have been blinding had the faceplate of Jason Thanos' combat environment suit not automatically polarized. That suit also protected him from being roasted alive by the backwash of superheated air. Not that his tingling skin felt particularly protected. He had, by virtue of his brain implant, detected the presence of functioning bionics just before the cyborg had appeared around a corner from a side tunnel with superhuman suddenness, bringing a rocket launcher into line. That small edge had enabled Jason to fire off a snapshot. Thus it was that he lived while the cyborg was enveloped in flame and incinerated. Its screams, Jason would not allow the thing the pronoun his, were inaudible in the general hellish noise. Now Jason proceeded on, motioning his squad to follow. His unaided strength would barely have sufficed to lift the plasma gun off the floor, but his form-fitting suit, while lacking the servo-boosted myoelectronic muscles of the Space Marines' golem-like powered combat armor, was more sophisticated. It had an inner lining of pressure sensors that allowed its nanofabric, with its microscopic electric motors, to not only duplicate the wearer's movements, as if the suit wasn't there, but also amplify his strength by a factor of almost 2. It was the kind of application of nanotechnology that could pass muster under the Human Integrity Act, for it had a legitimate purpose and it did not blur the sacrosanct distinctions between life and non-life. Between man and machine, between brain and computer, and it represented the cutting edge of late 24th century military equipment. Thus it was that Jason hefted a weapon that used a battery of tiny converging lasers to heat a superconductor-suspended hydrogen pellet to a plasma state and expel it through a magnetically focused field along the laser beam that drilled a tube of vacuum through the air. It wasn't a subtle weapon, even by the standards of today's military firepower. But this wasn't a time for subtlety. And even at this moment, in the midst of this firefight, he took an instant to reflect that it was a far cry from what he was accustomed to. For example, the black powder percussion ignition mini rifles and front-loading revolvers of the American Civil War on his last mission. Or the muzzle-loading smooth-bore muskets and flintlock pistols of the piratical 17th century Caribbean on the mission before that. Not to mention assorted swords, spears, maces, axes, and so forth in the course of his career as head of the Special Operations Section of the Temporal Service, the enforcement arm of the Temporal Regulatory Authority, which oversaw all lawful time travel. That word, lawful, was, of course, the rub. And it was precisely why Jason was here, on a mission in his own native time, somewhat outside his usual jurisdiction. Indeed, he was the cause of that mission. The transhuman dispensation had had 3 generations of absolute power, beginning in the early 22nd century, to try to remake Earth in their own twisted image. They had made full use of the time, employing genetic engineering, bionics, and perverted nanotech to generate distorted travesties of humanity. Specialized castes ruled by an elite of genetically enhanced supermen. But then the descendants of the colonists who had fled the hell Earth was becoming had returned to the homeworld on the wings of the faster-than-light drive they had invented. The revolt they had sparked had taken another 4 decades, but by 2270, the year of the Human Integrity Act, Earth had been washed clean by a torrent of blood. Or so everyone had thought, until Jason had returned from classical Greece with the horrifying truth. The transhumanist leadership, foreseeing defeat well in advance, had secretly prepared for it, carefully establishing a large, lavishly financed, and very well-equipped underground organization that was alive and well in the shadowy places of Jason's own era, still pursuing its mad dream of a self-created evolutionary step beyond Homo sapiens. Nor was that the worst of it. At some point after 2310, when Weintraub had discovered the theoretical basis for time travel, but before he and Fujiwara had perfected the temporal displacer 2 decades later, the transhumanists had stolen Weintraub's work, and they had discovered a flaw in Weintraub's math that was still sticking like a thorn in the heel of the authorities' time travel technology. Only a titanic installation requiring an energy expenditure that would have been beyond the capacity of any civilization that had not harnessed the power of matter-antimatter reactions could overcome it by brute force. The transhumanist's displacer, suffering from no such handicaps, was compact and energy efficient enough to be concealable, and they were using it in an ongoing campaign to subvert the past. And it got even worse. The time-traveling transhumanists had made contact with the Toloi aliens, who, as Jason had previously discovered, had created the human species and continued to meddle as best they could. Contacts between the two were fitful, but should they ever manage to effectively combine forces, the consequences did not bear contemplating. It was because of all of this that the Special Operations Section had been formed under Jason's command. It had foiled a number of the transhumanists' plots and on 2 occasions aborted their attempts to exploit Toloi contacts. But as Jason had known only too well, he was struggling in the dark with only the vaguest intelligence concerning his enemies. Then, on Jason's last mission to the final months of the American Civil War, a real break had finally come. Amid the flaming chaos of Richmond's fall, he had obtained a certain transhumanist data chip. It had not provided the one item the authority, and Earth's entire law enforcement community, most desperately wanted to get. The date known as the day when the transhuman nightmare was due to rise again. But it had been a goldmine of other information about the underground organization, including the second most desired item, the location of the illicit temporal displacer. Intelligence analysts had been skeptical at first, wary, as always, of cleverly planted disinformation. At the same time, in case it was genuine, the data had been tested out in ways that would not reveal the authorities' possession of it. For Jason had assured them that the transhumanists had no way of knowing the data chip hadn't simply been left in the ashes of Richmond's burnt district. Repeated, careful probing of unimportant targets had finally convinced the skeptics. Only then had this assault been authorized. It was, of necessity, a military, or at least quasi-military operation. But Jason had been assigned to it at his own request, as the authorities' liaison, and for his extensive and often sanguinary experience in dealing with the transhumanists. Thus, he had been aboard one of the 6 GV-73 armed personnel carriers, heavily modified for enhanced stealth and other purposes, that had unobtrusively rendezvoused at a point on the barren eastern coast of Patagonia, just south of the Rio Chico, at 50 degrees south latitude. It had been early southern hemisphere spring, and they had had just enough time to thank whatever gods they worshipped that it was not winter, as they endured the bleakness of a sea coast only 150 miles north of the Straits of Magellan. But then the prearranged time had arrived, and Major Rojas of the Internal Defense and Response Force had given the order. They had set out by night, westward, up the valley of the Rio Chico, and then turning slightly to port and following the tributary that led to Lake Viedma in the foothills of the Patagonian Andes near their southernmost end. Skimming the lake, they had continued on over the mountains on the wings of grav repulsion, following gorges flanked by conifer-covered slopes and granite cliffs, keeping to the undetectably low altitude permitted by terrain following radar and other sensors under computer control, No one had been in the mood to admire the scenery by the gathered starlight of passive IR imaging. Beyond the crest, the Andes had sloped steeply toward the Pacific coast, a fjord coast of labyrinthine waterways and islands, the mountainous chasms choked with immemorial glacier ice. Beyond the glacier, the fjord they had sought had snaked its way westward, past Saumarez Island, where there was some human habitation. But their objective lay before that, and Jason and the other men had grasped handholds to steady themselves as the carriers had surged ahead and simultaneously banked hard to starboard toward a huge but well-camouflaged entrance in the almost sheer cliff face bounding the fjord to the north. That cliff, they had known, was honeycombed with sensors and defenses, but most of these had a westward orientation, expecting any attack to come from the Pacific, beyond the maze of mountainous islands. So the transhumanists had been caught flat-footed when the formation of carriers had wheeled, and the lead two units, the ones that had been fitted with hard points from missile launchers of a sort usually reserved for spacecraft, had fired a rapid volley of two Firebird missiles, each at the entrance. This had not been an occasion for subtlety, especially given the lack of nearby human habitation. Nevertheless, the Firebirds' dial-a-yield laser-triggered deuterium fusion warheads had been set at their lowest yield, about 0.0001 kiloton of the traditional measure of TNT. It had proven adequate. The four simultaneous detonations had merged into a single momentary artificial sunburst that had blasted in the massive sliding doors. After riding out the shockwave, all six carriers had surged forward through the jagged opening, their plasma repeaters, larger rapid-fire versions of the portable versions, firing through the smoke into the interior, clearing the way by indiscriminately destroying anything and everyone inside. They had settled down on the floor of a cavernous space, now littered with wreckage and incinerated bodies and smoldering with scattered fires. The side panels of the GV-73s had fallen away and the IDRF raiders had sprung forth. Even though Jason's captured data had led them to expect this extensive grav-vehicle hangar, its size had still been a shock. Only lavish application of nanotechnology could have permitted the hollowing out of such a volume under the Andes unnoticed, even in this godforsaken near-Antarctic region. And this was only the vestibule, as it were, of the installation. At once, according to prearranged plan, the squads had fanned out, blasting down the few surviving transhumanist personnel in the hangar and headed for the hatchways that led into the bowels of the beast. As a kind of liaison officer and consultant, Jason wouldn't normally have been leading one of the IDRF squads, but he had a couple of special qualifications. For one thing, he held the rank of commander in the Hesperian Colonial Rangers, the paramilitary constabulary of his native world. Coincidentally, it was the same rank title he bore in the Special Operations section. So he was not unfamiliar with military-grade firepower, however rarely he had ever had to use it. But more importantly, his rank and duties entitled him to a neurally interfaced computer implant of the sort that flew directly in the face of the Human Integrity Act, but for which exceptions were grudgingly made for certain military and law enforcement officers. Among its many other functions, the implant projected directly onto his optic nerve a map of his surroundings, as long as those were programmed into it. Major Rojas, who had a very limited number of subordinates possessing such implants, had put Jason in command of one of the squads converging through separate tunnels on their common objective. Now, he quickly consulted the ghostly map display that seemed to float in front of his eyes, with the tiny red dots that showed the location of the other squad leader's implants. At first, those dots had seemed to exist in the near limbo of a very partial floor plan, but now, the map display was growing in complexity as the tiny but very sophisticated computer in his skull was swiftly adding details as it absorbed visual input. So far, so good, he thought. Just ahead, a ramp led up to a right turn in the passageway. A small sphere came sailing out from beyond that corner, hit the wall with a pling, and rolled down the ramp. Jason acted without pausing for a thought. "Grenade!" he yelled as he stepped forward and kicked the thing back up the ramp, and then instantly joined the rest of the squad in flattening himself against the walls. There was none of the shattering explosion he had expected. Indeed, there was little more than a loud pop near the top of the ramp and a spray of a viscous fluid. But then the walls and floor in that area began to lose their texture, dissolving into a gray goo. Spots of the same dissolution of matter sprouted down the ramp toward the squad as the fluid spattered. Jason's gorge rose as the invisible cloud of nanobots did their work of breaking down the molecular structure of matter. Corporal Wei clutched his arm and screamed as the microscopic agents of destruction ate through the nanofabric of the combat environment suit and into muscle and bone. Mere possession of the stuff was a felony, use of it on humans a capital felony. But Jason knew. The nanobots only remained active for 30 seconds. As he counted down those seconds, a second grenade came from around the corner. He fired at a range of only a few yards, blasting the thing into its component atoms in midair. Even inside his suit, his body was instantly bathed in sweat, and he was sure he could feel blisters rising. But, ignoring the intolerable heat, he sprang forward, splashing through the partially dissolved floor, and swung around the corner, plasma gun leveled. He faced an improvised barricade. The three defenders behind it made his gorge rise even more than the nanoweapon had. The transhumanists he had encountered on extratemporal expeditions had, of course, been ones who could pass unnoticed in earlier epochs. Some had been genetically tailored for extreme good looks, others for mere ordinariness, but all were of normal human semblance. But here, there was no need to blend. These were cyborgs of the soldier castes, grotesquely squat and muscular, and no attempt had been made to conceal or soften the obscene coupling of flesh and machinery. One of them raised an artificial left arm, incorporating an integral weapon, and the air crackled as a stream of electromagnetically accelerated flechettes went supersonic. Jason went to his right knee just in time. Someone behind him screamed briefly. But then other members of the squad piled around the corner, and a fusillade of plasma bolts reduced the cyborgs to charred flesh and melted metal. "Almost there," Jason called out, and led what was left of his squad through the shattered barricade. Ahead, a large doorway loomed. Beyond, they found themselves in a large open space, its walls lined with instrument panels and most of its floor occupied by a flat stage. That stage was larger than that of the authorities' installation in Australia, but that, Jason knew, was deceptive. This required no massive supporting equipment, and it was powered by an ordinary microfusion reactor. As he stared, a doorway on the opposite side of the chamber opened, and a group of seemingly normal humans, technicians by the look of them, burst in. One of them sprinted frantically for a control board, which, Jason was coldly certain, contained a self-destruction switch. "Stop him!" Jason yelled. But even as he spoke, another IDRF squad emerged from the far door and proceeded to blast down the transhumanists they had been pursuing. One man, not content to have killed the running technician, fired a second plasma bolt into the control board, which fairly exploded in a shower of sparks and a cloud of smoke. "Cease firing!" Jason called out. "We want to take all this stuff intact." "That's affirmative," said Major Rojas, who had just entered the chamber. She walked across the stage, looking around curiously, and stepped up to Jason. They both removed the hood-like, flexible helmets of their combat environment suits and took deep breaths of the ozone-shot air. "Everything under control, Major?" asked Jason, running a hand through his sweat-drenched hair. "Pretty much. We're mopping up. A good thing surprise was total. As it is, we lost too many men, and some of the things we lost them to. The Major couldn't continue. She was a hardened combat veteran, but she was also, inescapably, a product of her culture.
Yeah, I know. I saw.
Jason hoped the medics, following along behind the advancing squads, had gotten to weigh in time.
But take my word, it was worth it.
So we've all been told. Rojas looked around the chamber again. So this is it?
Yes. This is the transhumanist's temporal displacer.
Chapter 2.
Well, said Kyle Rutherford, gusting a sigh of relief and leaning back in his chair with a smile. That's that?
Is it? Asked Jason expressionlessly. Rutherford's brows knitted, and he gave the three people across his desk a sharp look. They sat in Rutherford's office, deep in the Temporal Regulatory Authority's vast displacer facility in Australia's Great Sandy Desert. The authority was a quasi-public agency, and its organizational structure was corporate. Rutherford, as its operations director, was the equivalent of its chief executive officer, reporting to the governing council that answered to a board of directors. As such, he rated a large office, although he kept, and actually preferred, a smaller one on the other side of the globe, in Athens, practically in the shadow of the Acropolis. But his inner sanctum was less opulent than most people expected, largely bare of ornamentation that might have distracted the eye from the display case along the wall behind the desk and the literally priceless objects from the past that it contained. It was against this backdrop that Rutherford now sat, stroking his neat gray Van Dyke, not in his usual insufferably self-satisfied manner, but in a nervous way that suggested reawakened worry.
Whatever do you mean, Jason? You've made a report favorable on all points. Yes, I know,
he hastily added, raising a hand against interruptions.
There are still many transhumanist cells to be located and rooted out. Indeed, the evidence turned up after that raid suggests that their top leadership is still at large. But now it is just a matter for ordinary law enforcement. We've taken their temporal displacer, so the past is secure from their subversion.
Can we be certain of that?
Asked Superintendent Alexander Mondrago, Jason's second-in-command in the Special Operations section. Like a number of Special Ops personnel, he was an ex-mercenary, and Jason could amply attest to his deadliness. Indeed, it almost lay in his genes, for he was a Corsican, who came of a long and violent tradition, not necessarily always a criminal one, as he was at pains to point out. He had once told Jason that he numbered among his ancestors a member of the Action Service of the French Secret Service, predominantly Corsican and with shadowy links to the Union Corse in the mid-20th century when the French state had been in a fight for its life against the extreme right-wing terrorists of the Secret Army organization. He had said it as though it meant something, and Jason was fairly sure it did. He was hazy on the details of the vicious underground war that had raged in France, but he had a pretty good idea that some highly unorthodox measures had been required. Rutherford gave the short, dark, wiry Mondrago a sharp look.
Of course we can be certain, Superintendent. We've taken their displacer intact. So, now they can send no more expeditions back in time, and as for the expeditions they have already dispatched, we can capture them as they are retrieved.
Any object, living or non-living, that had its temporal energy potential cancelled by the Fujiwara-Weintraub temporal displacer, or its transhumanist counterpart, and sent into the past, at least 300 years due to the uncontrollable initial energy surge required, was there until the temporal energy potential was restored. This was almost effortless, for temporal displacement was such a profoundly unnatural condition that a temporal retrieval device, or TRD, no larger than a small pea could do the job. whereupon the time traveler snapped back to the displacer stage from which he had departed, after the same elapsed time spent in the past, the linear present, as it was called. There had been some theoretical speculation as to what would have become of transhumanists awaiting retrieval if their displacer had been destroyed, but no one had wanted to do that, for it was still being studied intently, and it had been unnecessary. Now the stage under the Andes was constantly ringed by shifts of non-lethally armed guards prepared to paralyze anyone who popped into existence on that stage. Already Jason knew one group, dressed in somber frock coats and long female dresses, had been bagged in this manner. That they had yielded no information was disappointing, but not surprising. The pointlessness of interrogating transhumanist prisoners was well established. The personnel of the security-obsessed underground were equipped, knowingly or otherwise, with implants that automatically destroyed their brains at the touch of any kind of probing, or any attempt to surgically remove them. However, the internal evidence of certain objects in that group's possession had yielded a particular year and location, and a special operations team had been sent back to the sooty Manchester of the First Industrial Revolution to ferret out whatever long germinating devilment might have been planted.
That's true, Director, Mondrago nodded. Things seem to be under control since we captured their displacer.
He shot Jason a sour side glance, which Jason ignored. The Corsican was still pouting about having been denied permission to participate in the raid. The argument that both of the top people in the Special Operations Section's chain of command shouldn't be simultaneously put in the line of fire had failed to impress him.
But how can we be sure it's their only displacer?
A dead silence fell. It was not a consideration that came naturally to anyone. The stupendous cost of the authorities' displacer had always seemed to render it impossible, as a practical matter, to build more than one, even though there was no theoretical objection to it. But the transhumanist underground could build them on the cheap.
We can't be absolutely sure, admitted Rutherford. But remember, he added with the air of a man grasping at a life preserver, we have no evidence that any of the transhumanist expeditions you've encountered in the past originated from any point further in the future than the present time. Isn't that so, Chantal?
The small, slightly built woman sitting on the far side of Mondrago from Jason wore the look of studious concentration that seemed to sit naturally on her pale, regular features. She spoke in her always quiet tones.
Just so, Director. We have no evidence for that, or against it, for that matter. And what of transhumanist expeditions that Commander Thano and the Special Operations Section have not encountered?
The silence returned, more gloomy than before. Chantal Frey had been part of Jason's research expedition to the Athens of the Battle of Marathon. It had been then that he had discovered the existence of the transhumanist underground and its efforts to plant the seeds of an eventual transhumanist triumph in the blank spaces of the human past, outside the range of the observer effect that precluded changing recorded history. And she had been seduced by the transhumanist leader, genetically upgraded into a kind of charisma to which she had been peculiarly vulnerable. Jason had saved her from being cast adrift in the 5th century BC, and thanks to him, she was the first time traveler ever to have been returned to her own time after having her TRD cut out of her body. And without doubt the last one, given the authorities' horrified aversion to deviations from established procedures. Since then, she had lived in a kind of limbo, distrusted as a former defector, but valued for the insights she could offer about the transhumanists among whom she had for a time dwelt. Recently, the value had finally overcome the distrust sufficiently for her to be allowed on another extratemporal expedition. She had accompanied Jason and Mondrago briefly to 17th century Jamaica, where Jason had loose ends to tie together with respect to Zenobia, a she-pirate and transhumanist renegade of his previous acquaintance. The expedition had ended in tragedy amid the cataclysm of earthquake-shattered Port Royal. Zenobia had died as the observer effect required, and Jason had learned, or rather relearned.
Sample complete. Ready to continue?